Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Rahul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Rahul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, ELAWVATE.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net. And Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of Elevate is brought to you by the Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys use Expert Institute, right?
We do use Expert Institute, and it's fantastic to get different experts in different fields, but the best of the best. And you don't know until you do the research, and they do that all for us.
Today's show is also brought to you by FileVine. FileVine has a platform called Lead Docket, which is the state-of-the-art way of tracking all of your intakes and leads, particularly if you're putting money into advertising. You don't want to waste money by missing a lead or missing a good case. So it also doesn't mess up your case management software by keeping it in a different platform, just focused on your leads. So check out Lead Docket by FileVine. Also brought to you today by Steno. Steno is a product you've used a lot, Rahul, right?
Steno is fantastic as a court reporting company. In addition to that, if you haven't tried Transcript Genius, it is an AI-based search engine where you can ask it questions such as, with an entire case, all the evidence on negligence, and it'll pull all the deposition testimony from all of the witnesses and put it together in a seamless way with hyperlinks to the actual text. Amazing.
And if your state law allows it, you can also defer the cost of depositions till the end of the case, which is, we were just going through our budget, and transcripts from depositions is in the top five of our expense items. So it's worth checking that out. Our show is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. That's the case management software we use at our firm. Our staff loves it. We love it. Very intuitive, very robust, can be adapted to do a lot of different things from mass torts down to small BI firms. So take a look at that. Finally, Hype Legal is the firm that we use for our social media and for our website design and development. We just rolled out our new website about 2 months ago that was designed by Micah and Tyler at Hype Legal. We love it. We've had a lot of great response to it. So if you want to see their work, come to our site at gideonason.com. And if you like what you see, contact Hype Legal and see if they can do the same for you.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravapudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, I know you recently did some high-level social media depositions. How did all that go? Are you at liberty to talk about any of that?
I am not at liberty to talk about what was said, other than I had a great time and it went well. Trial's going to be in November, and then I get to share when it becomes a public record, everything about what's been going down in the cases. But what a righteous set of cases. It's just really sad and scary what goes on social media. And if you don't know, it seems like such a normal area to use, and everybody uses social media, but the level of addiction with children, and then the level of impact it can have on them is profound. So I am really excited about these things going to trial.
Can you just so you can set it up for later discussion, just what's the overview of the case?
Yeah, so there's about 25 attorney generals that have brought lawsuits on behalf of their states. I represent a number of individual plaintiffs, so kids. And the basis of the case is that, which is going against Meta, Alphabet, TikTok, and Snap. And it's that these platforms, as designed, are addictive and addict children to the platform. And then once they get addicted, then they spiral into really bad places. So the addiction, just a simple example, is especially with girls, 13-year-old, 15-year-old girls. They're on the platform innocently. They get addicted. They start to have what they call, even the social media companies call, social comparison. So they'll see a famous star and they'll say, oh, that person's so pretty. And then the social media platform will latch onto that and say, oh, this girl's interested in pretty people. And then that leads to the girl thinking, well, I'm not that pretty. And then ads for makeup show up. And then the person says, well, I just don't, makeup's not going to make me look pretty enough. And then that leads to all of the filters and other things on social media with the content creators saying, hey, look at me. And they create these filters, which you can only achieve by way of plastic surgery, but the person can't afford plastic surgery. So then on videos and everything else on the platform comes how do you do it yourself at home, and videos of kids cutting themselves and doing all sorts of other terrible things. And so what sounds innocent on the front end leads to self-mutilation, potential suicide, and other issues with respect to body dysmorphia. And so the dark side of these platforms is, it's awful. It's awful, and it affects so many kids. And so just kind of thinking of it personally, and I think, Ben, probably you too, anybody with teens as kids, it almost is common sense that these platforms are addictive. But what was never common sense to me until getting involved in these cases is the incredibly dark side of all of these platforms. And it makes me sick to my stomach.
Yeah, well, thanks for the overview. They're really compelling cases, and obviously a huge issue that affects almost everybody in society right now. So look forward to hearing more about it from you at a future date when you can disclose all of the internal workings that you've learned about. Well, we're thrilled today to have Austin Dana and Karen Zaka on the podcast. Karen's actually a repeat player. She was here to talk about a great verdict she had with Nick Rally, I believe, right?
In the Tesla case,
which was fascinating. She's back to talk about another great verdict she had with Austin Dana recently. But Austin, you're here for the first time. So why don't we find out a little bit more about you first? You're with a Ketch's law firm, as I understand it. And are you based out of Rhode Island?
I am. Yeah, the firm's headquartered in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, but I run the Rhode Island office for the firm. Been here about 2 years now.
Are you in Providence or?
Yeah, we're out of Providence.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, my wife is from Rhode Island, and we got married in Newport, so. Rhode Island holds a special place in my heart. Great, great state. We've got our illustrious Mark Mandel from Rhode Island, who we love. So, so you had your own law firm for a long time before you moved back to a bigger firm to run the Rhode Island office. Can you tell us a little bit about your decision making there?
Yeah. So after law school, I was at the public defender's office in Springfield, Mass. For a year. My father was a partner at a firm, and he left that firm, and we started a firm up together. Which we ran for about 11, 12 years until he retired. And that was right around the time COVID hit. So I was a solo, COVID was going on, and kind of was looking for a new home, a place where I could work collaboratively with other attorneys, bounce ideas off each other, and not just be in an office by myself, pounding my head against a wall all day. And that's how I ended up partnering up with Ketch's. They were looking to branch into Rhode Island. And I was looking for a good firm with support and other great attorneys that I could work alongside with. So that's kind of the path that brought me here.
And how did you and Karen partner up to work on this case?
So Karen had been at Catches for a brief period of time and worked on this case while at Catches before going to Trial Lawyers for Justice. So this was kind of a holdover case, and we got paired up on this one and maybe four or five others that we've been working on for the last 2 years or so.
How's Rhode Island treating you?
It's great. You know, winter's done, so everyone's happy about that. Spring's around the corner. Almost. We're getting there.
We thought our winter was down here in Maine, and then it snowed yesterday. So.
Oh, wow.
So do you guys want to give us kind of the backstory on the case?
Yeah. So our client at the time of trial was, and this was January of this year, was 24. And the negligence happened when she was 13. So it took a long time to get to trial. But so when she was 13 years old, she had a history of epilepsy, which was managed by a medication called Depakote. And then she had a breakthrough seizure in March of 2014, like a tonic-clonic seizure, so more severe than she had had in the past. And she went to Mass General and was seen by a neurologist who was in her last year of training and put her on a medication called Lamictal. So she added the Lamictal to the Depakote. Lamictal has certain risks with it. One of those risks is a condition called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which I don't know if any of the listeners know what that is, but it's horrific. It basically starts with like a rash all over your body, which turns into burns and the skin literally sloughs off. And it particularly targets areas where there's a lot of mucous membranes, so eyes, mouth, genitalia. But so the risk of Stevens-Johnson syndrome increases in the setting of co-administration of Depakote, which she was on. Also, if the dose is escalated too quickly or if it started at too high of a dose. So she was started at a dose of 25 milligrams. Our experts said it should have been 4 milligrams. The tricky part about the case is there was FDA guidelines in place that recommended children from age 2 to 12, the dosing be weight-based, which would have got us the 4 milligrams. But over the age of 12, it should just be the adult dose, which is the 25 milligrams. So that was a big sticking point for us because, you know, she was obviously 13. However, she weighed 61 pounds at the time, which is the average weight of an 8 or 9 year old. So our position was basically that the defendant should have deviated from the guidelines, recognized that she was underweight, and used the recommendation for ages 2 to 12. And then the Stevens-Johnson syndrome would have been avoided. Our client ended up getting the Stevens-Johnson syndrome, obviously. She was inpatient for, I think it was over a month. She's now blind in her left eye. The pictures of her when she was inpatient, the scarring in her skin are just catastrophic. Fortunately, she's recovered without too much scarring now. She doesn't have fingernails. There's scars where her fingernails should be. And one of the other issues is that she has vaginal strictures from this. So she's going to need vaginal reconstruction at some point if she wants to have a functioning vagina. So the damages are horrific. But since the case was filed in 2017 versus when we went to trial, she had improved exponentially. I mean, she went from having to wear sunglasses and using a cane all the time to now she's working, volunteering, can get around on her own in the sense that she can use Ubers to get places. She's really fought really hard to get where she is. So while the damages were horrific, she's come a long way, which is always, how's the jury? It's always an issue of how's the jury going to take this? You know, she's recovered, maybe she'll continue to recover. So that was one of the issues as well.
So she waited till she was 18 to bring the lawsuit, or?
No, it just took that long in Massachusetts to get to trial.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah. So the case was filed and she came into our office, and I think it was in 2015. Case was filed in 2017, and we didn't get to trial until January 2025.
Is that normal in Massachusetts?
That's a little long for Massachusetts, but not completely outside the realm of normal. Austin and I tried another case last September, a birth injury case that was filed in 2014, I think. Mm-hmm. So things move slower here than the rest of the country, I've come to learn.
Like the COVID backup.
COVID played a role, obviously, too.
So pre-COVID, what would it take to get a case from filing to trial?
I'd usually tell clients pre-COVID that it would probably be 3 to 5 years.
And then has that backlog been fixed?
It's getting better. I think the medical malpractice docket in particular takes longer just because our trials are so much longer in time, but it's getting a little better.
Wow. Okay, so tell us how this trial went. How long was it?
So it was about a week and a half. Jury selection started off pretty slow. We don't get panel as a matter of right here, so we can request it, but it's up to judicial discretion, and most judges here are afraid of panel for reasons unknown to me. But so we did get some attorney-conducted voir dire from counsel table with very limited questions. I'll let Austin talk about that because he took the lead on that.
Yeah, so the way that looks is you bring one juror in. They had filled out questionnaires before, so we had a little bit of information. One at a time, they're getting into the box and judge is asking some questions and then turning it over to plaintiff's counsel for 4 or 5 questions and then defense counsel. So we were very limited in what we could ask. We're trying to ask things like, can you award damages for non-economics versus economics and things like that. But after the first day, I think we only had 4 jurors in the box. And we needed to put our expert on Friday. So Wednesday, we have 4 in the box. We have Thursday to fill it up. So that limited us even more because we really had to hustle through it.
And we needed to see 14.
We needed to get to 14, yeah. So we needed to put 10 in Thursday. So we had to hustle through it, kind of kicking out who we could and the danger people that we could identify. But we really just needed to get the jurors in the box and quickly. So
it's taking so much time because you're doing them one at a time.
Correct. Yeah, one at a time. So unlike a panel voir dire where you can ask everyone the question, you can facilitate a discussion, you can't really dig deep with one person in the box. And whether or not that one person will open up like a group of people well, if you're having a conversation, is another question. You know, you're a lot more guarded if it's just you and the judge is sitting next to you and you're getting peppered with questions. So it was difficult. But we got through it.
Can you tell us a little bit about Massachusetts juries in general?
I think they tend to be pretty conservative, which is surprising because we're a liberal state, but depending on the county too. As far as counties go, we were in Suffolk County, which is downtown Boston. So that's probably one of the best counties you can be in for jury selection. But I think jurors here are sophisticated and we can't treat them like they're not. And I think they're generally conservative when it comes to awarding money. So you got to be careful to not oversell things.
I would also add in this county, there are a lot of hospitals in Suffolk County. And it's hard to find anybody who's not somehow affiliated with the hospital system, whether it's them themselves or a relative, or they treated at these hospitals in the past or well in the future. So that's always challenging in a med mal case.
So when one of these jurors comes in, potential jurors, are they hard-shipped yet, or do you have to go through that exercise as well?
So they'll raise their hand, like they get general statutory questions, like, do you have a hardship? But then we have to hear about it first. We go through the questionnaire and the questions they answered affirmatively. And then this judge, she was a great judge overall, but in jury selection, wanted to rehab everybody, which I think is why the first day took so long and we only got 4 people. But yeah, so we do go through all those questions, including hardship, too, when they come in one by one.
And then when do you exercise peremptory challenges?
So we did alternating peremptories. And after the judge did the statutory questions, went over the questionnaire, each side got an opportunity to ask a few questions. She'd ask the juror to step out for a moment, and then we had to exercise it there. So we don't get the whole view of who's in the box. You have to do it right then and there.
Now, in Massachusetts, you don't do expert depositions, right?
We do not.
So can you just give us a summary of your trial prep process? And do you do focus groups? Are you doing data? Or how are you assessing the value of the case and coming up with your case frames for trial?
Yeah, so we didn't do a focus group on this one, actually. But as far as experts go, I think sometimes not having depositions en masse works to our advantage, because then they're strictly limited to what's in their expert disclosure, which is often pretty vague and anemic here. So it helps us in that way that they're limited and they can't expand upon their opinions. A lot of expert research that we do typically is I'm looking at basically every publication they've ever written, because there's a lot of academic physicians here in Mass, and most of the ones that testified for defense are Harvard affiliated. So they have to publish as part of their job. So there's usually a lot out there, and there's usually some article where they've contradicted something that they say in the trial, and then really digging into what their opinions are. So for example, they had an expert pediatric neurologist who in this case justified the dosing based on the clinical trials for Lamictal. Well, when you look into all the clinical trials that were available at the time in 2013, none of those clinical trials tested this dose on a kid under the age of 16. So we really dug in that way too. But as far as case value and things like that, a lot of discussions between Austin and I, polling other people, other lawyers that we respect in the community, and talking to our client too, who was actually very reasonable.
And just on the depositions of experts, in Rhode Island, we can take expert depositions, but there are a number of people here who forego those with the idea that if you go into an expert deposition, you're just going to let that expert prepare, and he's going to be even more prepared for trial when you get there. And I think we kind of have found that to be the case in this trial, where when their expert's up there, he didn't seem as polished and prepared as he probably would have been had he been deposed before he took the stand. So yeah. It cuts both ways, I think.
And he was pretty green, which you could tell. I couldn't find transcripts for him online or anything. And you could tell on direct he was pretty green. So I adjusted the way I cross-examined him based on the fact that he was green, because I knew he wasn't going to be slippery enough and he'd probably be a little more honest than most experts if I phrased the question the right way, which he was. So it worked out.
How did you adjust your questions?
Less aggressive, I would say, and more clinical and rational, as opposed to trying to pin him down. Like, I asked some open-ended questions that I wouldn't normally ask a seasoned expert, but I could tell he was very academic and not well-versed in what the consequences of what his response would be in some circumstances. So I think I was a little more gentle with him than I would be with a seasoned defense expert.
Then what were some of the concessions that you were able to obtain through that type of questioning?
So one of their big sticking points, part of their defense, was that the dose was justified because by age 12, the liver has fully matured. And based on my research and talking to our expert, there's no set time frame physiologically where a child's liver is fully matured. And I knew he was academic and was going to be honest. So I said to him, like, you know, you said the liver was fully matured by the time our client was seen. Can you tell us more about that? When in time physiologically is the liver fully matured? And he fumbled and was like, you know, and eventually said, you know, I'm not really an expert on that. You'd have to talk to an endocrinologist or a pharmacist. I don't think there's a set time. So there are experts you can use the actual data with, and then there are other experts where you got to be more about the story. And I think he gave us some concessions because he knew what the data was and was ready to concede it.
That seems like a material issue in your case, knowing I'm not a med mal person at all. But I mean, if you're talking about multiple medications and the liver is not matured.
When I'm just curious, and when you give an overly high dose of that medication, does the negative impact, the Stevens-Johnson syndrome, does that happen right away? Or is there an opportunity to fix that by reducing the dose at some later date?
So it can take up to, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks for it to manifest. But before it actually manifests, there's no way to know it's going to happen. It's the damage is basically already done by that point. You just have to fully stop the medication. But it's like you've already set the fire. It's going to keep going. But that's why, you know, the argument is you want to start at a lower dose and gradually titrate up and see how the kid is tolerating the medication.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at PSRPlaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP, and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at PSRPlaybook.com and learn from the best.
Seems like a really hard case because you have the guidelines that seem to favor the other side, at least technically, right? And then I assume the defense is some version of, well, it's also really terrible if you have a seizure. And so we were trying to give appropriate medication levels to prevent a seizure. And if we gave a low dose and he had a terrible seizure, or she had a terrible seizure, we'd be in here answering for a different problem, right? How did you frame the case to overcome those seemingly obvious rebuttals to your position?
Well, I think the big thing was, usually in medical malpractice cases, defense is arguing that you need to use your clinical judgment and that medicine is an art and all this stuff. And this was one of the first cases where I feel like we were really pushing clinical judgment. Like, this isn't black and white. You need to look at this child. This is a unique child with a unique size and stature. You can't just plug her into this table on the guideline and say, well, my work here is done. You need to be putting things into context. And so I think that's the way we primarily argued that issue. As far as the seizures go, it's a cost-benefit analysis, risk-benefit analysis, in that you can still accomplish the same goal. The choice of the Lamictal wasn't a bad choice in and of itself, but just start it slower. There was no need to start her at this really aggressive dose. But they definitely argued that hard. They argued about her quality of life. They tried to imply at one point she had brain damage from her seizures, which blew up in their face. They were arguing that she could have died had they not given the dose of Lamictal because seizures are so dangerous. They definitely, you're right, Ben, that was a point that they argued really hard. Do you have thoughts on that?
On that point, I think one of our rebuttals to that is Nelsie hasn't been on Lamictal since this happened to her, and she's still here. She's sitting right there. She's fine. So there was just no need to start her off at this high dose. They could titrate up slowly. She was still going to be on the Depakote. And they were making this big thing out of these tonic-clonic seizures that, realistically, when you look at it through common sense, they didn't need to put her on this high dose of Lamictal. And by doing so, they raised the chance of the Steven Johnsons. On the guidelines, I think that was something we struggled with at the beginning. We actually prepped this case for trial once before the trial actually went, and defense counsel got COVID and we had to continue it. And I remember during those first meetings, sitting in the conference room and saying, what are we going to do with these? Like, this is bad. There's a guideline here that clearly says 13-year-olds don't get dosed based on weight. And she followed it. She followed it directly to a T. So we had to dig deeper into those guidelines and figure out what the justification of that was. And then we ended up using them for our own case. And I think they were very powerful for us because in the guidelines, there's a black box warning, this black box around a word that just says warning. And it has three things that will increase the chance of Steven Johnson's. And those are the things that Karen talked about earlier, starting too high, titrating up too fast, or giving Lamictal while a patient's on Depakote. So we really could lean into those. And I think that ended up helping our case, right? Because this is a dangerous drug. This is a bad thing that can happen if you do these things that it tells you not to do. And so what's the answer? The answer is clinical judgment. And that's what we expect from our doctors.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in most cases, the defense is all about judgment, where you're trying to hold them to some standard or guideline that they've violated. But it was nice to understand how you turned that around in this one. This reminds me of something I just saw at one of the conferences we were at, where there's now a restatement of medical malpractice. I don't know if you're aware of that. I hadn't been aware of it until about 30 days ago, but it's a part of it, just for our listeners who do this kind of work, is really terrible because it allows doctors now to utilize the guidelines as a sword and to dismiss cases where doctors complied with guidelines, that is a per se defense under the new restatement of medical malpractice, whereas violating the guidelines is not a per se negligence as drafted. So it's something that the plaintiff's bar that was participating in that process strongly opposed, but nevertheless, that got into the final version of the guidelines. So just be aware of that. I hadn't even known that there was a restatement of medical malpractice coming up. We've never had one before. It's part of that restatement of torts framework. But so this is a perfect example of where that would be really terrible to have that kind of a rule place.
Yeah, we actually tried to keep the guidelines out when we were gearing up for trial previously on hearsay grounds, which was denied, but it at least put the judge on notice that, hey, they're going to try to say this is the standard of care, black and white standard of care, and that's not the way this should be. It's something they can consider. And I think the judge did a good job with that issue and gave us an instruction saying just that. You know, the FDA guidelines in and of themselves do not establish a standard of care, but it's something that the defendant can consider when delivering care and ensuring she complies with the standard of care. So that was a helpful instruction to us too.
How'd you guys divide up the responsibilities at trial? And is there some strategy behind how you did that?
So I did the voir dire and then the opening. And then I think Karen did our expert. And then I put on the mother of Nelsie. Karen put Nelsie on and crossed their expert and also did Dr. Giblin, who was the defendant, and yeah. Karen Close. I think I covered everything there.
Yeah.
I don't know about philosophy going into it. I think we kind of just, hey, you want to do this and I'll do that. Just conversations during trial prep and kind of dividing it up as we saw fit.
Karen is the meaner one, so she does the cross.
Karen also has a very, very in-depth knowledge of medicine, which I've learned a lot from her, but she's very good on the medicine. So whenever you can put her up against an expert, you're going to do pretty well in my estimation. So I think it was a good call to let her handle those aspects of the case.
Thanks, Austin.
You're welcome.
When did you communicate to the jury what your ask was going to be? Did that come in voir dire, opening, or did you wait till closing?
So we're not allowed to talk about it until closing. So it wasn't until closing.
What are your thoughts on that rule?
I think it's ridiculous in the sense that, you know, we have the burden of proof. We got to cover all the issues, you know, negligence, causation, damages. I think it kind of restricts us from really exploring damages adequately if we can't talk about it in voir dire at a minimum. Basically, what we're limited to is some abstract, potentially large sum of money, but we can't even give a range of what that sum would be. And especially in Massachusetts, where I think jurors are a little more conservative than elsewhere, I think it would be helpful to be able to explore that more. Obviously, it didn't hurt us in this case, but we had some jurors that we sat that were very skeptical about plaintiff's verdicts and money being awarded. We like looked to each other at one point being like, was this a mistake that we sat this person? But it ended up working out okay. He seemed reasonable and turns out he was. So, but yeah, I think we should be allowed to explore that, especially in voir dire for bias.
Yeah, a lot of what we were hearing in voir dire with the limited questions we could ask, and most of those were just on the first day because the second day, again, we were flying through everything. Where, okay, yeah, I could award non-economics as long as you can prove it and that there's some justification for that, right? Which is fine. Okay, we will, and there will be. And then at the end, when we did prove our case and we did have the justification, that's when we're able to ask for the number. So I think it worked out okay. I think even if we were able to ask for a number in opening, in this situation at least, it may have been too soon and it may have turned people off if we're talking about numbers without proving our case first. I know there are different schools of thoughts on that, but sitting through this trial, I think it worked out very well for it to go that way. I agree, though, if we could explore it in voir dire, especially in a panel voir dire, it would have been very helpful.
So then, Karen, how did you address that in closing? What's your message to the jury to prepare them for the ask?
I do the whole spiel about there's no specific formula, but here's here's some tools you could use to reach a conclusion as to what number is appropriate here. And this is her one and only opportunity to get full and fair justice. She can't come back years from now and hope for more. And I basically did a per diem argument with a range. In hindsight, you know, once the verdict comes in, I'm like, should I have done a bigger range than I did? But I did, I think it was $100,000 a year versus $150,000 a year for 68 years based on the CDC life expectancy table. So it was, I think it was 6.8 to 10.2, and they awarded 8 right in between the two.
And what was the total verdict?
With prejudgment interest, it was 11.9.
So you don't do some version of the man in the black suit?
No. I don't know that I can pull that off. That's I leave that to Nick.
Yeah. And Massachusetts then obviously allows per diem debt arguments.
Yes.
For non-economics.
Yeah.
You've tried cases in a bunch of different jurisdictions outside of Massachusetts and New England. How do you compare the juries you find here in New England versus elsewhere? And does that factor into how you present the case?
Like I said, I think they're more conservative here. And I don't want to badmouth any other jurisdictions, but I think they're a little more sophisticated. There's a higher education level here than, you know, some of the Midwest or Southern jurisdictions in particular. So I feel like if I'm going to say something, I mean, you should always be able to back it up, period, if you want to maintain your credibility. But I feel a little more pressure for that here, because I think jurors here really want to see the data and the evidence to support what you're saying. And then I think there's a little bit more of an inherent distrust maybe of plaintiff's lawyers here. And I don't know if part of that is because we're limited with voir dire, so we don't really get to talk to them as much. We're also, the process for openings and closings is different here. There's no rebuttals here either. So it's one and done. But I think you got to be a lot more careful with what you say here, because jurors will really hold it against you. Those are my thoughts on that. What do you think, Austin?
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, we had at least one attorney on jury. We had a number of people who work in the medical field. So you can't get up and say something that's not going to ring true to them based on their life experiences. And they've been there. They have a base knowledge that you need to make sure that you're saying things that they can believe and they should believe. So you have a very educated jury. And I think they can be conservative. I think Boston in general is a very wealthy community, so that may skew in our favor. But I'd agree with what Karen's saying, that you're up against a jury that's going to see this case for what it is. They're going to test it against their knowledge that they have in the real world, and that knowledge is going to be pretty expansive. So,
no rebuttal.
Those schlubs there in Los Angeles who buy anything you tell them, right?
Rahul? In fairness, I haven't tried a case in California.
Nick's here right now. Nick is here right now in downtown LA in a trial with Dana Fox.
He's gone back to back to back.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, guys, thanks so much for doing this. What's up next for you guys?
Up next for me is actually going to be maternity leave. I'm due on May 16th. So I was 6 months pregnant when we tried this case.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's your first child?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep. That's big. Well, you'll have to make sure you get him or her an iPhone right away. Get plugged into one of those algorithms. And how about you, Austin? What's coming up there in Rhode Island next?
I have a trial over the summer with another Massachusetts attorney who I'm trying the case with, a case against our client's UM policy, where our client's driving down the road and, based on her telling of the story, a white car comes out of an alleyway, sideswipes her, and causes her to go into an intersection and get into a pretty bad accident. The insurance carrier says there's no white car. She just flew through this stop sign and did it all herself. So we'll see how that one goes.
Whoa.
But that's the next one on deck.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Was it a Ford Bronco?
Not a Ford Bronco. I wish it was. We could have the OJ case going on.
Guys, thank you so much for coming and telling us about your recent verdict and congratulations. I've had a couple med mals in Massachusetts in the last couple of years. I know how hard that venue is. So it's a probably one of the most difficult venues in the whole country to try a Med-Mal case, particularly given that it's the home of all those kind of world-class hospitals and so forth. So, and the law is not forgiving. You don't get a full fee. So there's nothing good about it, but you did a great job for your client. Great result.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Karen, great seeing you again, and congratulations on the baby coming, and wishing you all the best.
If you come on the show for a third time, you get a lobster shipment of a dozen lobsters.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Are you trapping them?
Well, no, I just, I'm the middleman.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.